Hello and welcome to the podcast from the Centre for Visual Cultures at Royal Holloway, University of London. We're back with a new series, Uncovered, where we shine a light on hidden aspects of the world of visual culture. Through conversations with artists, academics, and curators, we'll be going behind the scenes of exhibitions, delving deep into the art archives, and finding new perspectives on a multitude of visual media. In this episode, Royal Holloway doctoral researchers Caroline Harris and Bryony Hughes tell us how they curated Words from the Wild, The Nature of Poetry, a new exhibition which explores many different forms of poetry, all of which respond to the natural world. They talk about their eco-poetic practice, the challenges of putting together a multi-sensory poetry exhibition, and the importance of bringing poets into the conversation on questions of biodiversity, sustainability, and climate crisis. Caroline and Bryony, welcome to the CBC podcast.
Hi, Gareth. It's lovely to be here.
Hi, Gareth. Thank you for having us on the podcast today. My name's Caroline Harris, and I'm a creative practice researcher here at Royal Holloway, and I have just handed in my PhD thesis. I'm a poet, writer, editor, and publisher. I'm the founder of Small Birds Press, and I've worked with Bryony on quite a few collaborations now.
That's amazing that you can balance all of these things and put on an exhibition at the same time. That's quite a feat, Caroline.
It was quite tricky.
I think tricky might be a bit of an understatement there. Hi, I'm Bryony. I have also just handed in my PhD thesis in practice-based poetics. I'm a visiting tutor here at Royal Holloway, so I teach across English and creative writing programmes at undergraduate and master's level, and I'm also the poet in residence at the University of Surrey. I also edit the small press Osmosis Press, and I'm the editor of poetry in Resurgence and Ecologist magazine.
Amazing. I must congratulate you both on submitting your theses. I should also declare my interest here because I have had the privilege of being able to work with you both on putting together the exhibition that we're going to talk about today, Words from the Wild. And so we're going to talk about it in a bit more depth. But before we do that, I just wanted to introduce to our listeners this concept around which the exhibition revolves, which is eco-poetry. We could start with the question, what is eco-poetry?
Well, I suppose at its simplest, eco-poetry is poetry that engages with all the non-human others, plants, animals, birds, fungi, with whom we share this planet, but also with kind of mineral processes like, you know, the carbon cycle, and with weather, water, those kinds of processes in the world. And I suppose as well, beyond that, it's a way of trying to put those non-human beings kind of front and center, rather than it being our view, what does nature do for us? It's kind of about trying to be much more aware and to try and get across in a variety of different ways, whether that's close listening or engaging physically with non-human others, for example, kind of taking tracings or rubbings, or you have sound work as well, where people are using that as a basis for poetry or the poetry itself.
Amazing. No, to add to Caroline's wonderful description, I just have a couple of things. The first is eco-poetry defined by Jonathan Skinner. Eco-poetry is something that sits very much in opposition to what we would normally see as nature poetry. So when people think of poetry about the natural world, what might come to mind is Wordsworth and his daffodils. And eco-poetry is very much a movement away from, as Caroline stated, the kind of human perception of the natural world, and a shift towards putting at the front and centre the non-human alongside multi-species, thinking through different landscapes, thinking through different natural processes. And some really exciting examples include Juliana Spahr, and who's also a really exciting example.
So thinking about eco-poetry in the UK, Harriet Tarlow's work is kind of seen as having changed things. And you have poets like Zoe Scalding as well. And then you have people who are working with the book form, like Thomas A. Clarke and Laurie Cullark as well, where they're doing something different, which kind of moves into the territory of material poetry that we're thinking about.
Yeah. I really like this idea of getting away from that Wordsworthian ideal of the poet just, you know, being in a field or in a natural setting, and the poet's genius just emerges from being in contact with nature. It's different to that, right? It's more like a sort of collaboration between the poet.
Yeah, I think collaboration is a good word. I think there's kind of two strands. One that I see, for example, in Camilla Nelson's work, who is involved in the exhibition, is very much about really trying to put aside human assumptions and understand the ways that these non-human beings move in, maybe in a group formation rather than thinking about the individual, how, you know, what languages might be involved in their kind of way of being as they are rather than projecting human values or ideas onto them. And then I think the other strand is you could see through, for example, Joan Retallack's work, who talks about sort of procedural ecologies, if you like, so that it's not trying to mimic nature or try and get across an image of the natural world. It's about using processes in poetry that are analogous to what we see in the non-human world. So, for example, things like Mandelbrot and those kinds of sequences. So they're kind of two quite different strands, I would guess, of this sort of poetry.
Yeah, that kind of leads me to ask you both, where do you see your own work fitting into this, into eco-poetry? Is it something that do you identify as eco-poets? Do you feel like your work does engage with these sorts of themes?
So it was interesting what you were saying about the Romantic tradition, because I was thinking about how I first got into writing eco-poetry. And it stems, I think, from my childhood, where I wasn't like off on the moors doing the romantic, heroic poet thing. It was much more about looking at the black-headed gulls on the local recreation ground or walking along the little road near my house that went past the sewage works and then kind of exploring all around the Hogsmill River. So I think I've had that interest right from childhood. And then thinking about where my work is now, how it has kind of come from that, I think I'm just really, really curious and interested in different forms of interactions with the non-human world. So I've done some work with plants, my scrub series, where it was using cyanotypes to directly engage with plants in a garden for Singing Apple Press, and then writing poems in response to that. And then I would say that the other strand of my poetry is more kind of that more critical side, if you like. So I've done a lot of work around deer for my PhD, and there a lot of it is trying to bring attention to how we can think of deer as being quite cute and sweet, but they are very killable at the same time. So I did one of my book works, Cut Out Bambi. I physically cut out with a scalpel the shapes of the deer to sort of get across that idea of erasure. So I think that sort of fits into the sort of second strand, if you like, of what I was talking about in terms of a critical eco-poetics. And I think I probably was reluctant initially to use the term eco-poetry because I think I had certain assumptions that maybe it was closer to the nature poetry that we have been talking about. So it's only actually quite recently that I've used the term about my own work. Don't know about you, Bryony.
Yeah, I mean, I have never been averse to the term eco-poetry, I think because I was introduced to it through a critical lens. So I was already a kind of my introduction to eco-poetry was, how does this shift away from nature poetry? What is different? How does eco-poetry innovate, extend the ideas of nature poetry? But I only came across the term a couple of years ago, really. But I would say that looking back in my life, I would call myself an eco-poet through and through. And what I mean by that is that I took a lot of joy and creativity as a kid, as a teenager, and as a young adult in paying close attention to everything beyond the human. I wouldn't just kind of, you know, walk through a park and say, oh, isn't this a nice park, and leave it at that. I really want to get up close and personal with bark. I used to absolutely love taking crayon rubbings of different textures that I'd find whilst out and about. And I also did quite a lot of wild camping when I was younger too. And that really felt like a quite immersive bodily experience in the natural world. But where my work sits at the moment is I'm quite interested in, as Gareth mentioned earlier, this idea of collaboration. So I'm looking at how different weather systems, different root formations might inform poetic structures and also the structure of language, the structure of the poem on the page. So very much being guided by the natural world as opposed to me commenting on or trying to create a version of the natural world within my work. And where I'd say that my work very much deviates from nature poetry is quite a lot of it would not be described as beautiful. That's a word that I think is thrown around quite a bit when it comes to poetry, the beauty of poetry, when actually I'm quite interested in kind of the nitty-gritty and also turning our attention towards the destruction of the natural world. So yeah, kind of quite forceful weather systems, but also pollution. One of my pieces, Mudlarks, was an investigation on the Thames foreshore. And I initially went down there to partake in mudlarking. Do you know what mudlarking is?
Could you explain it a little for our listeners?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So mudlarking was originally something that was done for survival in the Victorian period. Usually young boys would go down to the foreshore of the Thames and kind of sift through the mud looking for objects and artefacts that had been washed up by the water to then sell on for money. Now it's very much on trend and is a kind of amateur historian activity where you'll kind of go down to the foreshore and excavate treasures. It's actually become so popular now that they've put a stop on who can have a license. It's become a lot more restrictive. So anyway, I was really interested in this idea of the mudlark and I wanted to go down to the Thames foreshore. But actually, when I got down to the foreshore, I wasn't so interested in the bits of ceramic pot or clay pipes that I could find. Instead, I quite liked looking at and working through the bits of plastic that were encountered. There was a rotting cabbage and a dead seagull, and actually that's what fed into my poem. So I suppose in terms of their subject matter, I'm not looking towards romantic visions of landscape, but instead the nitty-gritty, even when it is a little bit disgusting and distressing.
Yeah, it really is subject matter, you know, matter of all different kinds. It's I'm glad that you mentioned like this idea of beauty as well, and kind of going against the idea of the beautiful. Not to say that the exhibition isn't beautiful. It really is. It's a really beautiful exhibition.
Thanks,
but it does engage with life forms and forces that are often overlooked, like in that tradition of poetry. So
yeah, I mean, we do have a whole section on insects, and some of that work by Astra Papakristodoulou is about bees, and in fact the threat to bees, and then Riddell Olson's work. She's done some fascinating work with scientists developing biodar, which is using the kind of what used to be thought of as the noise in radar kind of weather forecasting, and using that noise to be able to find swarms of insects. So that's really interesting work that's going on. And yeah, Camilla Nelson, her work on worms, she's engaged with other, I think as well, like woodworm. So it's often these kind of overlooked species. And then it's bringing together systems as well and making heard what is unheard. So Liz K. Miller's work, Forest Listening, it's the sound of rain in a forest, but the microphone was buried near the tree roots underground, is my understanding. She's created from the sound outputs, the graphic versions of the sound outputs, she's created with a mix of hand drawing and cyanotype, made these amazing banners, which in our exhibition, they're all along the back wall, but they have actually themselves than being hung in woodlands. So there are lots and lots of different ways of, that this exhibition is engaged with non-human others.
Fantastic. So I wanted to ask you what sparked the idea for putting on this exhibition, all these works that you've already talked about. Were you aware of them already, and was it just a question of rounding them all up, or did you have a sort of initial idea first to put on your own work?
I feel like quite a few of the pieces in the exhibition almost can't exist on their own. They need to be part of a greater ecosystem, and that's something that I take really quite seriously with my work, wherein I will encounter other people's writing and use either their text or use some of their methodology as part of my creative process, almost as a kind of exchange of knowledge, but also an exchange of creative practice.
Well, it was probably about 18 months ago, I think, that we initially came up with the idea. And I think what you're talking about in terms of collaboration and networks, I think, you know, we knew a number of these people. They were influences on us. Quite a few of the people who are exhibited have some relationship to the poetic practice pathway at Royal Holloway. But then we have Kate Ciclosi, who's in Canada, whose work kind of is in conversation with Astra's Decayed piece, which is a piece of bark that she found, I understand, in Bushy Park. And then has delicate letraset on it. The letraset technique is also used by Kate Ciclosi. And actually, there's a great book, Judith, Women Making Visual Poetry. And that works by having a network. So each person who's in the book, then they recommended someone who'd influenced them. And I sort of feel our exhibition is a little bit like that. Mm-hmm. It's a real network of influences, collaborations. There's a direct collaboration in there in terms of mine and Kat Chong's work, Dear Dear, where we each reconfigured each other's work. So I really think that's the case. It's people that we were very keen to be able to show and to kind of give more of a showcase to, because this poetry, it kind of sits somewhere. It's not quite art and it's not quite traditional poetry. Therefore, it's about finding spaces where it can have a much bigger audience. And I really feel that this sort of material poetry, multi-sensory poetry, there are films, there's fabric banners, there's sculptures, there's images. I really think it has the potential to reach a much bigger range of people. I think it's another way of engaging people with poetry who might not be the kind of the standard audience, which is why it's fantastic to have it in this space at Royal Holloway, which is right by the library. You have students going there all the time who might just peek their head around the door and think, oh yeah, that looks good in there, who might be someone who's like, oh, poetry, I don't get that, I don't understand it. But they can come, they can actually touch some of the works, not all of them. So do make sure to look at the please do not touch signs as well. But things like some of the, you know, my fabric ribbons, for example. We had some amazing feedback that someone had spent 3 hours in there the other day and they finished reading a book. I love that.
Yeah.
You know, to just have different ways of engaging with this sort of work.
To an extent, I see the exhibition as almost like a growing expanse. And I mean that the physical space of the exhibition obviously holds the collection of poetries that we've curated. However, those poetries are often part of a wider project that can be accessed online or exists in different spaces. A really exciting example is J.R. Carpenter's contribution to the exhibition, which you can access via a QR code. So we're kind of moving the site of the exhibition beyond the physical space into the digital space. But I also think it's so important that it exists within the centre of our gorgeous campus, which is kind of brimming with wildlife and also multidisciplinary research on biodiversity, on sustainability. I think there's so much potential for collaboration across disciplines. Saying that, I was really excited the other day. I visited the exhibition to speak to some of the members of Poetry Society, which is a student-run society here on campus. And there was a very large number of them in the space, creating work, responding to all of the pieces that were existing there. So they brought their notepads into the space. They were using it as a kind of writing studio and generating new works. And I think that's really, really exciting in that I personally see whatever it is that they have produced as a crucial part of the original exhibition. I don't think there's a difference. I don't think they are responding to it. I'm happy to embrace that as part of kind of the ecosystem of Words from the Wild.
Yeah, definitely. You know, in some ways, it's a culmination in that it's the end of my and Bryony's PhDs, and it's drawing together work we've done during that time, work we've come across. But it is also very much a beginning, and we're exploring other ways that the exhibition extends beyond. So we're hoping to be able to create a set of audio descriptions, for example, which can then outlast the exhibition. There will also be a 360 tour, which is something that the culture team do for every exhibition. And I must just kind of give a shout out to the amazing culture team now. So Naomi Liebens, Peggy Ainsworth, Anya Eastman, they've been brilliant.
Absolute superstars.
Yeah, they have. All the things you've been saying so far really does underline how much of a collaboration and a conversation the exhibition really is. And it's fantastic to hear that it's generating all these positive responses already. So I just wanted to ask you about the kind of process that went into curating this exhibition. I'm wondering about the kinds of challenges and the issues you face in putting on a show of this size. I know that you already worked on an exhibition last year of your own work. So was it a case of sort of scaling that up? Or what were the other big differences between that exhibition and this one?
It's a really interesting question. I think there are big differences, but there's also lots of overlap. So the exhibition that you're talking about, Gareth, was Textual Porosity, which took place in the Winning Gallery in Hampton Court. And that was a collaborative exhibition between myself, Caroline, and one of the artists that's currently in Words from the Wild, Astra Papakristadoulou. I think number one, working with the space of Winning Gallery was very different to working with the exhibition space in the library. The Winning Gallery is an older building. It had these really kind of gorgeous wooden floors. It had lots of kind of cubby holes and crevices. So we had our work, and we very much curated and placed and framed our pieces according to that space. We were very much guided by the space. Whereas I personally, I'm not so sure if you agree, Caroline, but the exhibition space felt more like a blank slate, something that we had more control or agency over, which meant that we could curate these groupings. So the exhibition is broken down into several parts. The first is animals and birds. We have plants and fungi. We have insects, and we have weather and water. And that was dictated by the shape of the exhibition, the architecture. I remember we were sat in my office a few months ago drawing
with
a
Gareth.
Map. With Gareth.
Yeah,
yes,
I was
absolutely.
There.
Gareth
I was there.
We were drawing out a kind of bird's eye view map and trying to place all of the pieces that we're so excited about into groupings. And it was very hard to make those groupings because there's such a rich overlap between all of the pieces. We actually ended up having to discard a few pieces that just aligned with all of the groups. They didn't fit into any category.
Yeah, and actually, you know, I probably shouldn't be saying this, but my Clutie ribbons, they're in the plants section because they're hung in a tree. So they're a collaboration with a tree when they're hung. But actually, the subject matter is deer, so they're in the wrong.
But that's an interesting point, though, about, I guess, curation in general, and how, in a way, you have to present these works in ways that the audience can easily follow. These categories, they do help you through the exhibition, right?
They do, definitely. And I suppose I want to say a couple of things in response to, you know, Bryony, and also your questions. One is that even at the point of doing the Textual Porosity exhibition, that wasn't our kind of first experience, if you like, of curation or being involved in curation or being part of an exhibition, actually, because I had previously exhibited work with Poem Atlas, which is Astra's online gallery website, and that was where I came across some of the people that have now become kind of quite important touchstones for me in my work. So I kind of saw how Astra did that. And then I did do some very useful training, in fact, with Royal Holloway, which was all about looking at how can humanities scholars think about exhibitions as a way of bringing together their work. And we had, you know, really useful talks from curators there that were very helpful kind of guidance. And then Astra had invited various poets and artists to contribute work to an exhibition in the Art Park Gallery in Rhodes. And through all of these things as well, it's been, you know, and with textual porosity too. So, for example, I had funding from the Humanities and Arts Research Institute here at Royal Holloway. So it's kind of felt like I've been able to build a sort of a step-by-step, going from not knowing anything about putting on an exhibition to having work in exhibitions to then putting on a small group show and then this. And responding to your question about, well, how is it different or the same, I think you, Gareth, hit on kind of a key thing in terms of guiding the audience through. This is very much for a general audience, which meant that we had to think of it really clearly. So that was where the sections came up, and that was where Naomi and her team kind of really nicely guided us through, you need to do this, and we need it by this time, and, you know, without kind of harassing us or anything, but we knew what we needed to produce and by when. So when the designer would need the text, we had to make sure the text was accessible without being, you know, simplistic or patronising. It needed to explain for someone who doesn't know what eco-poetry is, who doesn't know what material or sculptural poetry is, kind of where this has all come from, and then kind of little texts, which again, you know, Gareth, you were involved in writing those, Bryony as well. You know, we kind of brought together our ideas in a way that we hope is going to be inviting for people. So really, we did have to think about it in that way. And also, it's a very professionally put on exhibition. So working with an external designer, working with external installers, so having to say, yes, this work goes here, and yes, they need to go in that order. And it all being made very secure because it's not a supervised exhibition. So some works which in other places we might have just clipped up with bulldog clips, it was like, right, no, they need to be framed to be safe.
Yes, you had to get the artist's permission for those as well, right?
Absolutely. So, yes, we have loan agreements with all of the artists. And, you know, so the condition is checked when the artists submit the work. They're kept very carefully in the art store at Royal Holloway, this great kind of underground, amazing store with all these bits of furniture and pictures that are from the gallery and, you know, founders building and stuff. Yeah, it's a kind of a whole other level compared with me, Bryony and Astra and friends and family putting stuff up in the winning gallery.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I also think you mentioned friends and family, and although our winning gallery exhibition was very much open to the public, I feel like our audience was people who are currently interested or already are interested in poetics or at least kind of visual art. That was the target market, if you like. Whereas obviously with Words from the Wild, it's in the university library and so many disciplines exist here, and we wanted to find a way for every single student on campus to be able to feel like the exhibition exists for them to enjoy as well. And I think one of the main difficulties is that the poems that exist in the space are not what you'd expect to see walking into a poetry exhibition. So number one, most pieces do not exist on paper or in books. Mm. Number two, there is a definite shift away from the left-hand margin or the poetic line in general. And number three, there's a wide exploration of materiality. So we have pieces that are on fabric banners. We have long kind of paper marbled scrolls. We have a book that is made out of beeswax, which is absolutely incredible. It's a shame that it's behind glass because it smells delicious.
Maybe that's why it had to be behind glass. somebody would eat it.
Absolutely. So for somebody entering that space who doesn't know too much about poetry or has a slight interest but maybe hasn't been able to read around the topic, it's going to disrupt prior knowledge. And as such, I think the categories that we established, although they feel slightly confined, they allow people to enter through comfortable spaces. They exist. They can kind of look at the work in pockets that they understand, because everybody knows what an animal is, right? But we might not know what a wild eco-poetry origami deer that is folded into a beautiful archive box and accompanied by a very large scroll by a collaborative poet. That might shock them a little bit. So it's kind of testing the boundaries between what is expected and what is unexpected. But then at the same time, as Caroline mentioned, there are some overlaps in terms of what is characterised where. So we haven't been as strict as you might expect with the categories. They very much spill into one another because you can't establish categories like that when it comes to the natural world. Everything's entangled, isn't it?
Yeah, of course.
Well, I like that you used that word entangled, because that makes me think about how your work is displayed in the space.
Oh, God.
That's quite creative, just by the way that it's displayed, right?
Mm-hmm. So I'm assuming you're talking about Weather Dialogue.
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay. Yeah, no, this is a story. So Weather Dialogue, just for the listeners, is a performance object. And what I mean by that is when I am reading the poem, the book forms part of the performance. So when I'm reading the poem, what I like to do is incorporate the text into the movements of my body. So it's a very, very, very long scroll that has been thermoprinted and then marbled by hand. And as I'm reading from it, I will unravel it, I will walk around, the text will move around my body, it will eventually kind of accumulate on the floor in a really kind of abstract structure. For Textual Porosity, our previous exhibition, I created an installation version. So this was significantly longer and intended to be hung from the ceiling so that the movement of the text via the wind that enters the space became part of what made the poem what it was.
Yeah.
For our exhibition now, the scroll Weather Dialogue has been given quite a bit of breathing space, and that allowed for us to become a little bit more innovative with how it was hung. So what we wanted to create was almost an immersive poem. So there's a cornered off section of the exhibition entirely dedicated to this poem. It's hung via, I don't want to give away the secrets of the trade, but it's hung using fishing wire. We've kind of created a net or a structure at the top of a corner of one of the walls in the exhibition space, and wove the poem in and out of that net so that parts of the poem would flow down and reach kind of at the reader's head length. Other pieces would twist and turn above their head. So it's kind of shifted from a performance object where the body dictates, I suppose, the movement of the poem and dictates how it is arranged in a physical space, to the poem has now become the physical space.
Yeah. It makes me think about other works in the space, but just how not all of the text is visible or meant to be visible in that sense. Like, there are folds and twists and turns, and we see that in your work as well, Caroline, with the deer.
Yeah, actually, the deer were part of the process of then writing the poems, the seven chimera poems for Kat Chong, which are on the little stands.
Mm.
This is in the tall cabinet on the left as you come into the exhibition. And so, yeah, so I'm quite interested in making the processes of translation or poem creation visible, kind of showing them. So, yeah, the deer, you could argue, are poems in themselves, but then they've been part of making these poems too. And I think there's a bit of a tension in the exhibition. So we talked about how it's a shame that you can't smell Astra's book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the things I've noticed is with some of the things that are more traditional bookworks or pamphlets, it would be nice to be able to see the other pages in some ways. And then with other things, that doesn't matter so much. So, for example, one of my other folded pieces, Deer Leg, part of the whole reason for the folding of it is that certain parts of the poem are either concealed or revealed. So it's part of the idea. Whereas I think, yeah, with some of the other book works, what was really nice at Textual Porosity was that we were able to say, come in, it's a bookshop, you can touch everything. And it would be nice to be able to, thinking ahead as well, to have more ways of people engaging in a multi-sensory way with some of these works. But, you know, there's always kind of little compromises.
But perhaps some of these issues can be addressed with the online element. You mentioned there was going to be a virtual tour, and that's in the works at the moment.
Yeah, that's normally a 360 tour that the culture team put together that then allows people to see all the way round. I think we probably won't be getting things out of the cases. But what I'm thinking of doing for when we do the audio descriptions is that because some of my works are created in editions, I can probably bring a full copy of the work along then for people to be able to engage with. We are hoping to do other events as well, we haven't got those announced yet.
Yeah, that's an important point, actually, about the audio descriptions. You mentioned that it's a multi-sensory exhibition, so it's great that there will be audio descriptions available of each of the works to make it more accessible.
Definitely, and also, for example, on the film works that we show, we have several different iterations. So one showing is with their own audio, one showing is with some soundtracks, one from Forest Listening, one from someone in the biology department, actually, who did a sound recording at the Knepp estate, which is kind of famous for being rewilded. It used to be just an ordinary traditional farm, and it's gone through this process for a number of years now of rewilding. And what we wanted anyway, to be able to have captions, subtitles on the films, and that made it very necessary as well, because, you know, people need to be able to see the text or hear the text. So hopefully we've got versions of those films that people are going to be able to engage with one or other form of the iterations of them.
I think accessibility is obviously really important. And I feel like the works in this exhibition almost give way to different modes of interaction, different ways of reading. So some of the works, as mentioned previously, you cannot access the entirety of the text. So actually part of your process of reading is looking at the shape of the object, looking at the materiality of the object, or perhaps touching the object, having that kind of physical hands-on interaction. I've found the experience of having everything in kind of glass vitrines quite strange, in the fact that when we've previously exhibited our work, and I'm thinking of the small publisher's fair at Conway Hall, it's all very much been on the table as part of a book fair where people feel comfortable, or at least are invited to feel comfortable flicking through the pages of these objects. So framing them and positioning them very much as pieces of fine art has been a completely different way of interacting with my own work. And I think one of the ways that we've almost moved through that is the way that we've held some of the texts in the cases. So we've ensured that some of the books that are kind of codex books, so a traditional book fold, are folded in such a way that they aren't flat or flush against the case. You can almost see a slight movement in the turn of the page, even though you can't access the page. It's almost like an additional page is implied, or that somebody could imagine turning the page if they really, really wanted to.
Yeah, it's really interesting, the contrast there with what you were saying about the small publishers' fair. So just to explain, so each year there is a small publishers' fair in central London, and the Poetics Research Centre, through Professor Adele Olson, has a table each year. And so students who are on the poetic practice pathway and PhD students and staff members of the research centre display their work, and it is really different, because you have to put out sample copies, or I do quite often, because people will come and they want to be able to leaf through. It's about holding these books and pamphlets and seeing how they move and react. So it is very different in terms of expectations and audience. So, I mean, it's so valuable, I feel, to have been able to have the opportunity to do these very different kinds of ways of putting our work out into the world for people to kind of experience it and for us to get their feedback as well.
Well, the feedback point nicely leads me into a question about the future, because the exhibition is on until the 24th of March. I'm wondering, in that time span, what are your hopes for this exhibition to reach other audiences, communities, and what kind of impact would you like it to have?
I've had quite a few conversations with colleagues regarding using the exhibition space as a teaching and learning and workshop space. I think that the different strategies of reading that the texts exhibited demand can align really nicely with new ways of interacting with more conventional or more conservative texts. So say, for example, if a student is struggling with, I don't know why I keep bringing up Wordsworth, but struggling with a Wordsworth poem, they feel like no matter how much they read it, they just can't access it. Actually, they might be able to use some of the techniques learnt through interacting with our exhibition to look at that text in a non-linear way. So, for example, looking at the shape of the poem, zooming in on a particular word, paying close attention to a particular word, and thinking about the implications of that word in relation to the wider poem. We've had several courses visit the space already. So there's a second year English literature course on literature and the environment, and the students had, I think, a jolly old time in that it was their first seminar, and their first seminar focused on poetry. So why not invite them into the space to explore the kind of broadening scope of what an eco-poem can be?
Perfect. That's really important. I think as a teaching resource, it does have a message, right, that ties in with climate crisis, with reduction in biodiversity. Yeah. Do you see the exhibition as having a positive impact in that sense?
I hope so. I think it's probably the engagement by the poets involved is very direct. And I guess, you know, it'd be interesting to know how much kind of audiences and visitors to the exhibition pick up on those themes in the work. I guess our point of view is that the climate and biodiversity crises call on us to do things differently, that it's not just business as usual, and also call on us to look not just to science and have arts like, oh, that's just about the communication, but how the arts can help people to understand what's going on, to express their own thoughts, to engage with their local environments as well as thinking more widely. It's different ways of getting involved. And I think what poetry can do is it can engage both the heart and the mind. And this is what is coming up over and over again. It's like, that is really important. It's helping people to understand. Also, as well, there are many people, and we know this, you know, from students here at Royal Holloway, there are big issues around eco-anxiety. So feeling that there's a space where it's okay to talk about that, but also people have said that the space itself with the bird song can be quite calming in itself, so hopefully helpful in that way for kind of mental well-being. So I think it really is putting the arts and humanities forward as being central to all of our thinking and action around climate, for example. And certainly the Living Sustainably catalyst here at Royal Holloway is working in an interdisciplinary way where the aim is to really try and value all of the different disciplines and what all of them can contribute and get groups of people working together on different research projects, but also in terms of public engagement as well. You know, we are part of ourselves here at Royal Holloway as sort of an ecosystem with our local communities, in terms of we have the ecosystems of the grounds and then we have the ecosystem of all the local residents and businesses, and there's some amazing activists and campaigning and eco groups and real kind of champions for eco-action amongst our local councillors, for example. So it would be nice if we can find some engagement with all of that that's going on as well locally and invite people in and onto campus as well as part of what this exhibition can maybe contribute.
I certainly don't think that somebody will enter the exhibition and suddenly never use a plastic bottle again. But I think it's, as Caroline said, definitely serves as a space for opening up conversation, hopefully between lots of different people working in lots of different disciplines. But even if it's just a friend passing by after collecting a book in the library who mentions, oh, okay, interesting, the poets are talking about the climate crisis. I hope that that just kind of shifts mindsets. And actually, on the topic of the interdisciplinarity, some of the pieces within the site were made from the very beginning as interdisciplinary artistic practice. So looking back to Redell Olson's weather radar, that was a collaboration between her and a group of scientists working in bioradar. You know, and the work that was created was a bringing together of two very different disciplines.
What I would say as well is that one of the other things that poetry can contribute is that it can hold complexity. It can hold paradox. There's not a need to simplify things down. And that it does feel very important at the moment when there seem to be so many forces in the world trying to make things simple. I think that space where you can be like, well, I feel this and that as well, and that's not a simple answer. And to hold things open, to hold things open for discussions, I think that that's an important role that poetry can play.
Yeah, I really love that. Yeah, a space for paradox.
A word that I really like is speculation. And in the exhibition space, we've positioned underneath the feedback box a small creative activity for those who are entering the space, which asks them to speculate on what our weather systems, landscapes, and cities, urban spaces, might look like in the year 2075. And I think speculation is something that occurs across disciplines, but I think it's very much a creative process.
Yeah, I love that prompt, and it has been receiving some good feedback from that already, right?
Yeah, so if you're visiting, please do answer the creative prompt as well as giving your feedback.
Yeah.
You can answer with words or drawings.
So it just remains for me to thank both of you, Caroline and Bryony, for being here and for this lovely conversation, and to say congratulations on the exhibition.
And thank you too, Gareth, and for all of your work towards the exhibition as well.
Thank you so much, Gareth and Caroline. It's been really lovely chatting to you this afternoon.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Uncovered. To find out more about Words from the Wild and the Centre for Visual Cultures, you can find links in the episode notes. If you have any thoughts or questions about what we discussed, you can email us at centreforvisualcultures@rhul.ac.uk. You can also follow us on X, Twitter and Instagram, both at @rhul_CBC. Thanks again to our guests Caroline Harris and Bryony Hughes, and to the Media Arts Department for their assistance with production. The episode was hosted and edited by me, Gareth Hughes. The music is by Gaspar Senna, and it was produced by the Centre for Visual Cultures. See you next time.